This program is intended for individuals who are blind or are unable to read physical print and is brought to you by CABVI's Audio Information Services team.
Good morning. This is Melinda Cornforth. I'll be reading from the Washington Post from April 30th, 2024. The front page, parties see hope for a Gaza ceasefire. Maybe this time it will work. Mediators expressed hope Monday once again that Israel and Hamas were inching toward an agreement to halt fighting in Gaza and release dozens of Israeli hostages, a last best chance to prevent a return to full-scale war. The signs of optimism came after Israel presented terms to negotiators last week that softened its position and broke new ground, according to an Israeli official familiar with the deliberations. "There is hope," a Hamas official in Turkey told the Washington Post, but he cautioned that key points require clarification. Like others quoted in this report, the official spoke on the condition of anonymity. Final decision rests with the militant group's leader, Yahya Sinwar, who is believed to be in hiding in the tunnels beneath Gaza. Hamas negotiators are expected in Egypt on Monday. An Israeli official said that the government is preparing to send its own negotiators after the Passover holiday. President Biden and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu discussed the talks in a phone call late Sunday. Secretary of State Antony Blinken is scheduled to visit Israel on Wednesday as part of a renewed regional push to secure the long-sought breakthrough. Speaking at a World Economic Forum event in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, Blinken described a major effort involving Qatar, Egypt, and others. Right now, Hamas is before it a proposal that is extraordinarily generous on the part of Israel, Blinken said. British Foreign Secretary David Cameron, also in Riyadh, said that the deal on the table was for a sustained 40-day ceasefire, roughly in line with the six-week pause that negotiators say that they've been working towards for months. A former Egyptian official with knowledge of the talks has said that the initial truce would involve the release of 33 hostages, a figure echoed in Israeli media. Israel had originally demanded the release of 40, while Hamas offered just 20 in its rejection of the last proposal. Cameron said that thousands of Palestinian prisoners could be freed from Israeli jails in exchange. But those figures are just one piece of a complex diplomatic puzzle. The Hamas official in Turkey said a number of essential points have yet to be put in writing, including the return of displaced Gazans from south to north and the complete and permanent withdrawal of Israeli forces from an east-west corridor that divides the enclave in half. The most important thing for Hamas is the withdrawal of Israeli troops and the end of the war, the official added. It was 3 weeks ago that international mediators last said a deal could be near, one of several times that expectations have spiked since a deal for a brief pause in fighting was reached in November. The talks fell short each time since, with each side blaming the other for the collapse. These efforts come amid fast-shifting circumstances, including a looming Israeli assault on Hamas's final stronghold in Rafah, rumors of imminent international arrest warrants for Israeli leaders, and ongoing efforts by Washington to broker a normalization agreement between Israel and Saudi Arabia. "Everything is linked together," said the Israeli official familiar with the deliberations. "Maybe this time it will work." Egyptian officials who visited Israel for talks on Friday said that they were encouraged to hear Israeli cabinet officials for the first time accept the idea of a long-lasting halt to the fighting and express willingness to hold off on an attack of Rafah if a deal can be reached, according to the former Egyptian official. Israeli leaders have been adamant that they cannot wrap up the war in Gaza without going after the final Hamas battalions that they say are holed up in Rafah, where more than 1 million displaced civilians are also sheltering. Signs of an impending invasion are mounting, including the call-up of two reserve battalions and the construction of tent cities by Arab charities in areas where Israel hopes to draw people away from Rafah. Israeli airstrikes in the city Monday killed at least 20 people, Gaza health authorities said. Mohammed Al-Magur, a spokesman for the Gaza Civil Defense Agency, said crews were working to find survivors trapped under the rubble. In a statement, the Israeli Defense Forces said it struck targets where terrorists were operating within a civilian area. Washington has told Netanyahu that the United States cannot support a military invasion in Rafah that does not provide for the safety of displaced families. The administration has not yet seen a plan that gives us confidence that civilians can be effectively protected, Blinken said Monday. The Israeli government is under intense pressure from hostage families to reach an accord. Daily protests are growing. About 2,000 protesters packed the streets near Israeli military headquarters in Tel Aviv on Monday, lighting fires and threatening to block a major highway amid a heavy police presence. Moderates have become more willing to push back on government hardliners who call for continuing military action over peace talks. Finance Minister Bezalel Smotrich, for example, told Israeli media Sunday that reaching a deal in Cairo would amount to a humiliating surrender. Benny Gantz, a member of the opposition who joined the Emergency Unity government 5 days after the October 7th attacks, responded that any government that blocks a hostage deal would have no right to exist. Entering Rafah is important in our long campaign against Hamas, but the return of the hostages captured on October 7th is of much greater importance, Gantz said in a statement. While wary of threats to topple the government for his far-right partners, Netanyahu might be willing to forego a Rafah assault and agree to a longer-term ceasefire for the right hostage deal, according to the Israeli official. They will have to frame it differently because internally they can't call it a permanent ceasefire, the official said. Analysts warn that statements coming or leaking from both sides may be little more than negotiating tactics. Hamas, which Blinken says Monday was the only thing standing between the people of Gaza and a ceasefire, is under pressure from Qatar and Egypt to show flexibility. Israel wants to demonstrate that it did everything possible to reach a deal before possibly moving into Rafah. Israel has also been roiled in recent days by rumors that the International Criminal Court in The Hague may be about to issue arrest warrants for Netanyahu and other top Israeli leaders in connection with an investigation into possible war crimes by Israel and Palestinian militants. The ICC declined to comment on the reports Monday, and it remained unclear where Israeli officials got their information. Netanyahu tweeted Friday that Israel will never accept any attempt by the ICC to undermine its inherent right of self-defense, and the country's foreign ministry directed its embassies around the world Sunday to be on alert for anti-Israel protests. There's a great deal of fear about it, the Israeli official said. The key risk for Israeli officials will relate to travel, said Eliav Leibovich, an expert in the international law at Tel Aviv University. It should be recalled that the ICC can also issue secret arrest warrants, which could create a more general chilling effect, he said. Under mounting international legal pressure, Israel has stepped up efforts in recent weeks to deliver humanitarian relief to Gaza, Leibovich said. U.S. officials have touted the progress, but they say that they are pushing for more. It's not enough, Blinken said Monday. We still need to get more aid in and around Gaza. Class of 24 faces bittersweet college graduation amid ongoing protests. Sam Nahines arrived at Columbia University in the fall of 2020 and spent the year taking classes online, hardly the vibrant Ivy League experience he'd expected. Now he, like college seniors across the country, faces the prospect that celebration of 4 years of hard work will be upended should commencements be disrupted because of student protests over the Israel-Gaza war. I really wanted my parents to see me with that diploma and that cap and gown, said Nahines, 31, a New York native, who's about to earn a creative writing degree. I really wanted to do it for them, and I imagine that a lot of students are feeling the same way. It is indeed a bittersweet moment for the class of 2024, some of whose high school graduations were forced onto Zoom by the pandemic. From Boston to California, many are mourning the upset of these fleeting moments of their academic lives and how they are again bearing the brunt of international events outside their control. Protests over the Israel-Gaza bloodshed began at Columbia nearly 2 weeks ago, and have sparked a nationwide movement of dissent on campuses. More than 900 students have been arrested. College administrators are reexamining commencement programs in the wake of heightened security concerns, grappling with ways to honor students' right to free speech while ensuring safety. Even those ceremonies that go forward are likely to be more muted than in past years. At the University of Michigan, for example, graduates have been told that banners will not be allowed and protests can be held only in designated areas. One institution has already announced a cancellation, and the news late Thursday from University of Southern California triggered anger and dismay there. USC's decision to call off its main commencement on May 10th, an event that usually draws more than 65,000 people, followed a decision to pull the commencement speech of its 2024 valedictorian, Osna Tabassum, who has publicly supported Palestinians. I've never felt more discouraged, disappointed, and frankly furious, said Georgia Nolan, 21, a real estate development major at USC. As a class, we did not get a high school graduation, and so receiving this news feels like a slap in the face. A shadow has been cast over what should be two of the biggest milestones in our early adult lives. Alex Ornes, 22, a graduating senior studying theater, said the university's latest move felt like the path of least resistance. It's like the school saying, oh, you protest against us, we'll just cancel everything, she said. Ceremonies for USC's individual colleges are still scheduled, though graduates are limited to 4 tickets for family members. Ornes has 6 family members coming to town for graduation, meaning 2 will have to watch remotely as she walks across the stage. I'm disappointed, of course, but there's a part of me that thinks none of this matters in the grand scheme compared to what's going on in Palestine, she said. Others share her ambivalence or see opportunity. Jackie Campos, 21, a senior in sustainability studies at the University of Texas at Austin, considers both the pandemic and the Israel-Gaza protests as less of an imposition and more of a movement for her cohort of students to take charge, a moment for them to take charge. While in high school, she served on a group that managed a pandemic response. This month, she joins demonstrations on her campus in support of Palestinians, which on Wednesday ended with a mass arrest of 57 people. We're not afraid to show our power, she said at one of those protests last week. Having youth-led movements is what's going to ultimately lead to change. Campos turned out in part because of the excessive and unconstitutional police crackdown. Within days, the county attorney dropped all the charges, citing deficiencies in the documents submitted by police. The show of force spurred her to focus more on continuing the protests, as well as on getting UT President Jay Harzel to resign for his role on the crackdown, than on whether the university would hold in-person commencement on May 11th. We need to continue showing up, she said. On Friday at Columbia, mere yards from the protest encampment on its main lawn, students posed for pictures in their blue graduation gowns on the library steps. Some worried about what would happen to their graduation ceremony, for now scheduled to be held in the same expanse on May 15th. Rumors and theories flew. Would an agreement be reached in time to avert cancellation? Would the ceremony be moved to Yankee Stadium or a place off campus? On Monday, Columbia University President Nemat Minush Safik said in a statement that the administration and the protesters had not been able to reach an agreement during negotiations. She urged the students to voluntarily disperse, saying that the protests had become a distraction for those studying for exams. Said she wanted to reassure the community that we will indeed hold a commencement, stopping short of saying whether it would be held in its traditional locale at the heart of campus. The class of 24 has lived with disruptions since before they were born, said Teji Vicky Kumar, 21, who's about to receive a bachelor's degree in computer science and visual arts. The student body president and her fellow classmates, members of what's known as Generation X, came into the world in the months after the September 11th terrorist attacks, which she feels has contributed to a collective anxiety. It's striking how little normalcy has been in our lives, she said. In high school, we started with Donald Trump being elected and then mass shootings, Black Lives Matter, Me Too. And when we're ready to enter the real world, COVID hits. We start college and Roe v. Wade gets overturned and now we're here. Here means a continued tent vigil on the Butler Lawn Library where students are calling for the school to divest its financial ties to Israel. Protesters with scarves obscuring their faces prepared snacks next to a fence dotted with green, red, and black Palestinian flags and signs that read, "Demilitarize education and justice for genocide." I think my age group is kind of used to this, she said. It would be different if you had really idyllic childhood. That doesn't feel like what this is. Our grade is used to rolling with the punches, and that's a good thing. Naheen's a veteran who flew overseas drones for the U.S. Air Force, is ready to wrap up what he calls one of the toughest years of his life. He had long considered Columbia a refuge from post-traumatic stress diagnosed from his time in the military. Then came October 7th, Hamas attack on Israel, when militants killed about 1,200 and took hostages, prompting an Israeli counterattack that the Gaza Health Ministry says has killed more than 34,000 in Gaza. Like other Jewish students on campus, Naheen said that he has since endured anti-Semitic slurs. He said he suffered his first panic attack in 2 years last Tuesday and got through it by breathing deep and hugging his emotional support retriever, Ghost. Ever since October 7th, things haven't been the same, Naheen said Friday. He has heard the protesters' chants of death to America and death to Zionists and seen others, their faces obscured by scarves, filming him as he stood with counter-protesters and waved an American flag on the library steps opposite the tent encampment. There were other, more painful losses. Naheen's and a buddy had been planning to travel to a conflict zone like Israel or Ukraine after graduation and filed dispatches from the war, Ernest Hemingway style, but the friend withdrew emotionally after the Israeli attack on the humanitarian group's food convoy in March that killed 7 aid workers. Then Naheen saw that his buddy had posted a photo of the bombed-out aid car on Facebook and written, "Invade Israel, wipe it off the map." Stunned, Naheen texted his friend, "Do you think Israel should be wiped off the map?" "Yes," was the reply. He has grown closer to other friends, some of them veterans like himself. The silver lining is that you really figure out who your friends are during a battle like this, with a near war zone on campus, he said. In some twisted way, I'm a little bit grateful. 4 officers fatally shot and 4 injured while serving a warrant in Charlotte. 3 members of a U.S. Marshal Service fugitive task force were fatally shot during a standoff Monday while trying to serve a warrant in Charlotte. A Charlotte police officer died hours later from injuries he suffered during the incident. 4 other law enforcement officers were wounded, and the person that they were pursuing was killed. The task force members were attempting to serve a warrant for possession of a firearm by a felon when they were met with gunfire at Charlotte residence, police said. The Marshal Service confirmed that one of the task force members who was killed was a deputy U.S. Marshal. North Carolina Governor Roy Cooper, Democrat, confirmed that the other 2 task force members were officers who worked in state prisons. Another task force member and 4 Charlotte-Mecklenburg police officers were also struck by gunfire, and one of the police officers was in critical condition, officials said Monday evening. Later that night, the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Police Department announced that Joshua Iyer, who had been an officer there for 6 years, had died. The others involved in the standoff were not identified. President Biden expressed his sympathies in a statement Monday night, describing the officers who were killed as heroes who made the ultimate sacrifice, rushing into harm's way to protect us. In the statement, he also called on Congress to ban assault weapons and high-capacity magazines, require safe storage of guns, and pass universal background checks and a national red flag law. "We must do more to protect our law enforcement officers," he said. "That means funding them so that they have the resources they need to do their jobs and keep us safe. And it means taking additional action to combat the scourge of gun violence." Charlotte Mecklenburg Police Chief Johnny Jennings described the incident as a tragic day for the city of Charlotte and for the profession of law enforcement. "Today we lost some heroes," Jennings said during a news conference on Monday evening. About 1:30 p.m. Monday, members of the task force approached a Charlotte residence to serve the warrant, Jennings said. They were met with gunfire from the person they were trying to serve with the warrant. The task force members returned fire, and the person died in the front yard of the residence, Jennings said. As the task force members approached that individual, they were met with more gunfire from inside the home, which led to a long standoff between law enforcement and the people inside the residence, Jennings said. Police questioned 2 people who were inside the home as people of interest Monday. The investigation is ongoing. U.S. Attorney General Merrick Garland said Monday evening in a statement that the officers put their lives on the line to apprehend some of our country's most dangerous criminals, adding that the Justice Department is heartbroken by the deaths of 3 of our own law enforcement colleagues. Charlotte Mayor Vi Lyles, Democrat, wrote on X that she was deeply saddened by the incident. Composed of numerous member agencies, the Carolinas Regional Fugitive Task Force is headquartered in Charlotte. Since it started operations in 2018, the task force says it has apprehended more than 8,900 fugitives. Officials, who on Monday praised the officers for their bravery in serving the warrant, faced questions about the decision to attempt to execute it early in the afternoon when schools were in session. Some schools in the area went into lockdown and residents in the area sheltered in place. "When you're talking about a felon who has a propensity to carry a firearm, there's no great time to do it," Jennings said, "whether it's in the middle of the night or in the middle of the day." Jennings, who worked in the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Police Department for more than 30 years, said that he couldn't recall another incident like Monday's. The last time Charlotte police officers were killed by gunfire while on duty was in 2007, according to the police union's records. Two officers were fatally shot after they responded to a domestic call, though their shootings were unrelated to the call, the Charlotte Observer reported. One of the most recent U.S. Marshal deaths in the line of duty was October 2021, when a deputy was killed in a vehicle accident. This is a good example of what we try to tell people every single day, that when we put on this uniform, Jennings says, that we don't have any guarantees that we'll return home. And some world news. Spanish leader Sanchez to stay in power after resignation drama. For the past 5 days, Spanish Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez, one of the continent's most influential liberal voices, had his nation gripped by a question. Would he or wouldn't he resign? The bizarre political drama seemed straight out of a telenovela. After the opening of what he called a spurious investigation against his wife, the dashing leader invoked familial honor in an emotive letter that meme makers quickly set to a song on social media, and which he wondered whether it was worth it to continue in his post. As he reflected, leaving the country in suspense and blaming his political enemies for mudslinging that had brought him to the brink of resignation, thousands rallied on the streets to show their support. He finally announced his decision after a portent-filled meeting with King Philip VI. The climax was ultimately anticlimactic. He said that he would stay. National address, the 52-year-old from the center-left Socialist Worker Party used the moments to reflect on a political reality that is today the norm far beyond Spain. Americans in particular can relate to it, the bitter polarization between right and left that has led to a total breakdown in civility, the decay of discourse to the point that it has become what he called a perversion of democracy. He asked, "Is this what we want for Spain?" "My wife and I know this will not stop," he said, adding that they were grateful for the support of the past few days, which, he said, has helped him to reach a decision. "I have decided to stay, to continue with more strength, even as the head of the government of Spain." Sanchez called for a collective recollection. "We should decide what kind of society we want to be," he added. "I call on Spanish society to become an example, an inspiration for a world convulsing and hurt, because the evil we are confronted with is far from exclusive to Spain. It is part of a global reactionary movement that aims to impose its regressive agenda through falsehood and defamation, hatred and fear." Sanchez is known for risky political gambits, but the past days reflected what analysts saw as a new height in Spanish political theater, even for him. It was perhaps a tactic aimed at whipping his fractious alliance of disparate parties in parliament into line at a time when its increasingly weak government has been unable to muster the votes to pass a budget. That alliance, which includes unruly Catalan separatists, is largely built on one shared goal, a desire to prevent the rise of conservative government that would or could contain the far-right Vox Party, a political force anathema to them all. Sanchez may have been sending the smaller parties he counts on to govern a reminder that he is the only person standing between them and such a government, but in this process, he may have also undermined his credibility with the nation, created a serious uncertainty about in the country without this leading to a significant change, neither on his political principles nor on his parliamentary support, said Pablo Simón, a political analyst and professor at the University Carlos III of Madrid. "This is very counterproductive and has been rather irresponsible on his part." Sanchez's abrupt announcement of a period of reflection last week had captivated more than just Spain. European watchers were abuzz with speculation that the Spaniard, known as Mr. Handsome, might be a contender to lead the European Council, which represents the bloc's leaders, or even as a long-shot challenger to the frontrunner for the new head of NATO, the outgoing Dutch Prime Minister, Mark Rutte. His decision to stay provoked a predictable backlash from the political right, which has intensified its opposition against the Prime Minister following his decision to back a law to amnesty hundreds of Catalan separatists in a bid to shore up his position in Parliament. Santiago Abascal, head of the Vox Party, described Sanchez's maneuver in a news conference as a coarse, indignant attempt at victimization. Alberto Núñez Feijóo, leader of the larger center-right opposition People's Party, had initially denounced Sanchez's move last week as an act of narcissism and infantilism unthinkable for a mature person. He did not hold back Monday after Sanchez's announcement, saying, "This is not comedy, this is tragedy. Spain doesn't have a leader equal to its citizens," he told reporters. "For this, I want to ask Spaniards for forgiveness in the name of the political classes and patience in the name of reason." Among politicians in the small parties that backed the prime minister's coalition in parliament, reaction was mixed. Some, like the Basque Independence Party EH Bildu, appeared to support Sanchez's decision to highlight incivility, but other partners were more critical. "This has been the last act of comedy that has lasted 5 days in which people's feelings have been played with, which has ended in a performance in the form of a sermon, a sensationalist gesture without concrete proposals to combat the ultra-right," said Perez Aragonés, head of Catalonian government. Sanchez's minority government faces critical tests in the coming months. His socialists are poised to best separatist parties in local Catalan elections next month, which could cause at least one of them to pull their support for him on the national level. In June, Sanchez will face key elections for European Parliament, in which the right wing is poised to make gains that could embarrass his government. The drama that led to the announcement was triggered Wednesday after news broke that an investigating judge in Madrid had opened a case against Sanchez's wife, Begoña Gómez, over alleged corruption and influence peddling. The investigation was sparked by Manos Limpias, Clean Hands, an organization linked to the far right that filed a complaint based on news reports, largely in the conservative press. Those reports claimed that Gomez took advantage of her position as wife of the prime minister to secure a bailout for the Spanish airline Air Europa. Pandemic-era corporate bailouts, however, were par for the course in Spain. Spanish media outlets have reported that neither Gomez nor the public prosecutor's office were informed about the investigation, and that only the editors-in-chief of the media organizations have been called to testify. Later that day, in an unprecedented move, Sanchez published a letter to the citizens on social media calling the case part of a harassment operation to try and bring me down both politically and personally by attacking my wife. Sanchez accused the leaders of the PP and the Vox of involvement. In addition to the case against his wife, Sanchez's government also is facing an investigation into an alleged scheme by an aide of the former Minister of Transportation to collect illegal commissions on pandemic-era medical contracts. Sanchez, a trained economist, has led the Socialist Party since 2014 and was the first politician in Spain to kick out a sitting prime minister through a no-confidence vote in 2018. He emerged as one of the continent's leading liberals. His threatened exit came at a time when the European left has suffered defeats in Portugal and the Netherlands, and the far and right, center-right is poised for major gains in the European parliamentary elections in June. During his two mandates, he has focused on gender equality, increasing the minimum salary by law, reinforcing workers' rights, and protecting LGBTQ+ and women's rights. Some of those efforts, particularly a transgender law that allows people as young as 16 to legally change their gender on national IDs without medical supervision, sparked a significant backlash, including with his own party. Scotland leader Humza Yousaf resigns in latest setback for independence. The leader of Scotland, First Minister Humza Yousaf, abruptly resigned Monday, roiling Scottish politics before general elections later this year. Yousaf, who also served as the Scottish National head of the Scottish National Party SNP, which has been battered by financial scandal, announcing his resignation from the podium at Butte House, his official residence, Yousaf said that he felt Scottish independence, his party's long-held goal, was frustratingly close, but in reality, after 17 years in power, the SNP's dream seems as out of reach as ever. Yousaf was facing no-confidence votes in the Scottish Parliament this week after he broke the SNP's power-sharing agreement with the Scottish Green Party. Without the Greens, the SNP is left with a minority government, and Yousaf appears to be the first victim of that new reality. On Monday, he acknowledged that he had clearly underestimated the hurt he'd caused the Greens by suddenly severing the coalition. The SNP and the Greens had served together under a deal struck by Yusuf's immediate predecessor, which bolstered the Greens' agenda of rapidly decarbonizing Scotland. Yusuf's government, however, abandoned its pledge to reduce carbon emissions by 75% by 2030. The trouble for the SNP was that Scotland still has a fossil fuel economy based on its extraction of oil and gas in the North Sea. The Greens also wanted to press ahead on bolstering rent controls and banning conversion therapy, while the SNP sided with the National Health Service guidance on pausing access to puberty blockers for those under 18 years. Yusuf said that he would continue to serve as first minister while his party elects his replacement. It has 28 days to do so. With the resignation announcement, the SNP finds itself at a new low. Yusuf's immediate predecessor, the long-serving Nicola Sturgeon, stepped down as first minister in February 2023, suggesting that she was tired of the spotlight and missed getting a coffee with a friend or going for a peaceful walk. "In my head and in my heart, I know that that time is now," Sturgeon said. Last week, Sturgeon's husband, Peter Murrell, was charged with embezzlement of funds from the SNP, which may have included the purchase of a $120,000 recreational vehicle found parked at his mother's home. Muriel has served as chief executive of SNP for 22 years. Sturgeon herself was questioned by police detectives but released with no charges filed. The couple's home was searched. In his resignation remarks, Yusuf said that as a boy born to Pakistani immigrants in Glasgow, people who look like me were not in positions of power. "Today, the evidence is quite to the contrary," Yusuf said, pointing to himself as well as the First Minister of Wales, Vaughan Gething, who was born in Zambia, and the British Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, whose parents of Indian descent immigrated to Britain from East Africa in the 1960s. Yusuf will continue to serve from the backbenches of Scotland's parliament. Elon Musk visits China as Tesla seeks green light for self-driving cars. Tesla received some encouraging news during CEO Elon Musk's two-day visit to China, overcoming a major data security hurdle and sealing a deal to use maps created by China's biggest search engine, moving it one step closer to being able to use its autopilot technology in the country. Both were positive developments for Tesla, which reported a steep plunge in profits last week as it tries to convince Chinese regulators that its full self-driving FSD software is safe for use, despite repeated crashes in the U.S. Beijing has been cautious about FSD, both because of safety concerns. Three people were killed in China on Friday in an apparent autopilot accident involving an SUV made by a domestic company, and because it wants to ensure local car makers aren't left behind. Tesla has reached a deal with search giant Baidu to use its street-level mapping data in China, a person familiar with the agreement said, speaking on the condition of anonymity. This comes with a credential of the highest level of surveying and mapping qualifications, clearing a key obstacle to later approval from the government, the person said. Bloomberg News first reported that Tesla had struck a partnership deal with Baidu, clearing a key regulatory hurdle for Tesla to offer its driver assistance system in China. Under the deal, Tesla will deliver its autonomous driving services based on Baidu's mapping and navigation functions. That came as all cars produced in Tesla's Shanghai Gigafactory were declared to be compliant with the country's data security requirements. The government-backed China Association of Automobile Manufacturers said that it will allow Tesla vehicles to park or drive near government and military-related properties. Tesla's had previously been banned from such areas, with officials citing potential security risks and concerns over what data the carmaker could collect. Those fears have now apparently been assuaged. The green light on the data security could signal a change, some experts said. Data compliance was once the most outstanding restriction faced by Tesla, said Kui Kajun, a Chinese automotive industry analyst. Now that's been cleared, I see no major hurdles policy-wise for full self-driving entry to the Chinese market. Musk sat down Sunday with Premier Li Qiang, who was in charge of Shanghai in 2018, when Tesla became China's first wholly foreign-owned automaker and opened a sprawling manufacturing base in the Chinese financial center. Li, a royal lieutenant of top leader Xi Jinping, had previously called the Tesla founder an old friend. At a state guesthouse reserved for foreign government leaders and some of Beijing's most important guests, a smiling Li told Musk that Tesla's gigafactory in Shanghai had been a paradigm of success for foreign enterprises in China, according to state media. The Chinese foreign ministry and state media didn't confirm whether Musk raised the issue of the FSD system, but the vice president for Tesla China, Grace Tao, wrote on social media that Musk told Li about his expectations for autonomous driving and artificial intelligence. Earlier this month, Musk wrote on X, the social media platform he owns, that the FSD rollout could happen very soon. Media outlets report Monday that Tesla had made progress on these issues during Musk's visit. Chinese officials had tentatively approved the company's request to launch its FSD software in the country, the Wall Street Journal cited an anonymous source in saying. The first hint that the Chinese government was reviewing Tesla's request favorably came a year ago when Chen Kile, a deputy director of Shanghai's Intelligence Manufacturing Promotion Division, told state media that the municipal government would boost ties with Tesla in bringing autonomous driving and robot modules to Shanghai. While the progress does not give Tesla immediate access for FSD, it is at least a display of confidence from Beijing, said Kui, the analyst, adding that a partnership with the Chinese company may help alleviate security concerns. But others said that regulators in Beijing had little incentive to facilitate a fast rollout by a foreign company when rival Chinese automakers such as XPeng are trying to gain an advantage over Tesla by releasing similar software. There's no strategic value for Beijing to support FSD's domestic rollout when there are highly qualified domestic alternatives, tech analyst and equity researcher Junheng Li said on X. There are still plenty of doubts about the reliability of self-driving software. Crashes in China and the U.S. have raised alarms about safety and prompted regulators to go slowly. After a two-year investigation into Tesla's autopilot, the U.S. National Highway Safety Traffic Administration identified hundreds of crashes, 13 of them fatal, and is now reviewing whether Tesla's fixes during the December recall of 2 million vehicles went far enough. Tesla insists that drivers are solely responsible for crashes, but lawsuits and federal investigations contend that Tesla exaggerated the capabilities of the autopilot feature, creating a false sense of complacency that led drivers to tragedy. In China, electric car companies also are reeling from a series of deadly crashes associated with autopiloting mode. A Chinese-made AITO M7 electric SUV powered with Huawei's autopiloting technology crashed into a sprinkler truck on a highway on Friday in Shaanxi, killing all three passengers, including a two-year-old boy. Seres, the Huawei-backed car maker, said that it is cooperating with police for an investigation into the case. Tesla's sales in China are dwindling in the face of intense competition from domestic rivals. Tesla accounted for 3.7% of total car sales in China last month, almost one-fifth lower than in March of last year, according to the latest data from China Passenger Car Association. A couple articles from this science page. The cicadas are coming, and some may be flying salt shakers of death. This year's double emergence will be a goldmine for scientists trying to unravel the many mysteries of periodical broods. This spring and summer, people in parts of the American Midwest and South will get to experience a numerically magnificent wildlife event, a rare double emergence of periodical cicadas. With the arrival of brood 19 and brood 13, trillions of harmless baby carrot-sized insects will be singing their hearts out from Wisconsin to Louisiana, Maryland to Georgia, and many places in between. The last time these broods co-emerged, the year was 1803. Thomas Jefferson was the president, and the Louisiana Purchase had just been completed, which means that many of the states where cicadas' love songs will soon fill the air were not even officially part of the nation yet. It's as impressive as that is, this year's entomological phenomenon will be extra special for researchers hoping to unravel the evolutionary mysteries of bugs that only crawl out of the ground in roughly 13 and 17 year intervals. Broods are not the same thing as species, and each brood can contain multiple cicada species that can emerge in different places. In 2024, all seven cicada species will be represented, a coincidence that won't happen again until 2037. That means this year's emergence will be a data collecting goldmine. One of the more unusual mysteries scientists hope to investigate involves a parasitic fungus that attacks adult cicadas, turning them into what one expert calls flying salt shakers of death. So it's pretty spectacular from the standpoint of a scientist that's interested in cicadas, said Matt Casson, ecologist at West Virginia University. Cicadas are true bugs in the insect family Hymenoptera. Famous for their repetitive courtship calls, cicada adults are large, loud, and highly conspicuous. But most of the cicada's life is spent below ground as a nymph. Cicada nymphs are probably among the most underappreciated forest herbivores, since most of the time they're out of sight, making a living by sucking juices out of the roots of trees and other plants. They emerge in the spring or summer when the soil about a foot below ground reaches 64 degrees. Nymphs then climb up the nearest vertical objects and molt into their adult form. Those winged adults spend their brief but riotous lives mating and, for the females, laying eggs. Cicadas can be broken into two general types: annual cicadas, which tend to have black or green eyes and can be heard every year, and periodical cicadas, which usually have red eyes and only emerge in 13 or 17 year intervals. While they are nymphs, these long-lived insects must escape the cold by burrowing down below the frost line. In some parts of their range, such as with Wisconsin, that can mean living in depths of more than 5 feet beneath the surface. This makes every emergence important for scientists. If a researcher studying a species of zebra or puffin wants to take genetic samples, they may have to endure hostile environments or treacherous journeys, but at least those animals are almost guaranteed to be present in any given year. The same is not true for a given cicada species. They may technically be there, but they are too deep underground to find easily and to access without causing significant harm to the animals. Casson said that he has tried and he came up empty. In addition, cicada broods don't usually sync up. It's been 9 years since such a thing took place last time. And when they do overlap in time, they tend to be spread out in space, with emergences happening several states away from each other. This means some questions can only be investigated in certain places at certain times, depending on which broods are on deck that year and which species they contain. This year, though, cicadas from brood 19 and brood 13 will butt right up against each other, mostly in Illinois, and this is where things get scientifically exciting. Casson hopes to study a cicada-afflicting parasite known as Mesospora. When its fascinating fungus infects an adult cicada, it floods the insect with amphetamine and psilocybin, each of which appear to influence its behavior. For instance, although the fungus has taken over the lower third of the body, replacing its abdomen and genitals with fungal tissue, the cicada appears to feel no pain. Instead, infected cicadas seem to want to party. There are some hypersexual behaviors, Casson said. The males pretend to be females to get other healthy males to come and attempt to mate with them, and that's probably a strategy by the fungus to increase the number of individuals that the fungus is able to infect. The parasite typically affects less than 5% of given cicada population, but once infected, those chalky white abdomens sprinkle spores everywhere they go. Casson is trying to conduct genetic work to learn more about how the fungus persists in animals with such unusual and disjointed life cycles. This year, he will be able to collect contemporary samples from a 13-year brood for the first time. Old archived specimens have been used in the past, which could yield some interesting results. Although we have limited data, some of the DNA sequence data from the 13-year broods are somewhat different from the 17-year broods, and it makes me wonder if there's actually some genetic differences in the strains, he said. Researchers are also interested in the fungus as a source of new medicines, Casson added. It has been used as a traditional form of medicine for inflammation among cultures in China and New Zealand's Maori. Because brood 19 and brood 13 overlap in very few areas, it's unlikely that any locale will experience twice as many cicadas as usual. With several million cicadas emerging per acre, a doubling of that would be, well, intense. It's also unlikely most people will notice a difference between broods in areas where the two are adjacent. They look identical, they sound identical, and genetically they're pretty much identical, said Chris Simon, an evolutionary biologist at the University of Connecticut. This is not always the case. For instance, Magicicada neotridentesium is a 13-year cicada that will emerge this year as part of brood 19 in Illinois. That species is nearly twice as large as Magicicada septendicula, which will also emerge as part of brood 13, appearing a little to the north in Illinois, as well as in Iowa and Wisconsin. For scientists like Simon, the real opportunity is in much less obvious distinctions. She wants to learn more about how cicada broods count the years, something she's trying to understand by sequencing whole genomes and looking for genes or groups of genes that control whether the cicada follows a 13 or 17-year cycle. One of the most interesting things is that we thought that the year classes or broods were reproductively isolated, because we thought they had an exact life cycle and the adults would never see each other, Simon said. But it turns out it's not exact, and sometimes they come out 4 years early or 4 years late. This means that the different broods can still exchange genes with each other, likely to be driving further evolution of the species. When 13 and 17-year-old cicadas come out in the same year, you can actually do hybridization experiments, Simon said. The last time she had a chance to do such work was in 2015 and 1998 before that. Simon added that inexactitude in cicada timing is thought to be on the rise due to climate change, which is elongating the nymph's growing season underground. Similarly, climate change can affect their distribution, as evidenced by brood 6 becoming more established in the Washington area in recent years, she said. Sometimes over the course of hundreds of thousands of years, 17-year cicada broods turn into 13-year cicada broods. Other scientists want to better understand how cicadas affect the plants that they prey on, as well as how trees defend themselves against the herbivores. Some studies show reduced growth in tree rings, for example, as well as lower yields in orchards where cicadas are present. However, cicada emergences have ecological benefit too, providing a smorgasbord of protein for predators, as well as boosts in phosphorus and nitrogen for plant life, thanks to trillions of decaying insect bodies. According to a study from 2005, cuckoos have more offspring in years following cicada emergences, while other bird species, such as crows, seem to fly away from the emergences, presenting yet another ecological enigma. If you're out during this year's emergence and your dog or toddler happens to gulp down a cicada or three, don't worry about it, said Marl Curatel, collections manager of insects at the Field Museum in Chicago. Cicadas can't bite or sting, and they're perfectly edible. It's going to be loud, Curatel said, but especially for the 13 and 17-year cicadas coming out in Illinois, it's going to be a once-in-a-lifetime experience. This unlocks solar patterns that could help understand space weather. The sun is more than a heat lamp for Earth. It is constantly spitting streams of solar particles our way, and sometimes powerful pockets of solar material that can jolt our planet. Now, scientists are unlocking another puzzle piece on which may drive extreme solar activity, which could bombard Earth and disrupt our technology. The missing piece could be linked to unusual patterns of high energy bursting from the sun's surface, according to recent research. We're used to hearing about the sun's ultraviolet radiation, which we protect ourselves against with sunscreen. The sun also emits much more powerful gamma rays, which are the most energetic waves on an electromagnetic spectrum. Each gamma ray photon carries a billion times as much energy as an ultraviolet photon. Gamma rays don't directly affect people on Earth's surface because the photons are absorbed by our atmosphere. But scientists are investigating If some of these very energetic rays could trace solar activity, such as the sun's powerful outbursts like solar flares or eruptions on its surface. Such strong events can create space weather, which can hit Earth, affect satellite operations, and knock out railway or electrical systems. Predicting extreme solar events would be a huge improvement in our understanding of the sun, like predicting an earthquake before it strikes. In a recent study, scientists found that some portions of the sun emit more intense gamma radiation than others, a surprising finding because models previously hinted that gamma radiation should be uniform across the sun. The latest research found the sun's poles emitted the highest radiation during the moments the sun's north and south magnetic fields flipped. It's about having better tools to predict the solar activity, Bruno Arcioli, co-author and researcher of the University of Lisbon, University of Trieste. Maybe we could use this new information from very high energies to help our models predict the behavior of the sun. The scientific reasoning for the strange orientation is still a mystery, the authors say, but the sun's magnetic field is likely to flip in the next year or two, allowing scientists to observe this oddity in real time, gather more data to explain the phenomenon. Gamma rays are the kings of all energy. They're generated from the most energetic objects in our universe, such as supernova explosions or neutron stars. Nuclear explosions and lightning on Earth can also produce gamma rays. The sun can also emit gamma rays through a few avenues. When an eruption of the sun sends off gas and plasma from its surface, gamma rays can also be emitted, but in relatively small energy levels. The bigger source of solar gamma radiation comes when very energetic particles emitted from supernova and neutron stars across the universe called cosmic rays bombard the sun. When the charged cosmic particle hits the sun, it gets turned around by the sun's magnetic field and comes back out. On its way out, it hits gas on the sun's surface and excites solar particles into gamma ray photons. This gamma ray conversion, astrophysicist Tim Linden said, probably takes place 100 to 1,000 kilometers below the sun's surface, where the magnetic field is strong enough to turn the cosmic rays around. With gamma rays in the sun, we get to see a few thousand kilometers below, said Linden, an astrophysicist at Stockholm University who was not involved in the study. That can give you a probe of what's happening very deep below the solar surface. The sun's activity is not constant. Every 11 years, our host star goes through a costume change where its north and south magnetic poles switch place, known as a solar cycle. As the poles flip, the level of activity at the sun's surface changes. The sun is the least active at the beginning, known as a solar minimum, and the most active around the middle when the magnetic poles officially flip, known as a solar maximum. The sun is expected to hit its solar maximum in the next year or so. In the new study, researchers studied how the sun's gamma radiation changes across the entire solar cycle using data collected from NASA's Fermi Gamma Ray Space Telescope. They found gamma radiation was the most intense at the sun's poles as solar activity peaked during the cycle, coinciding when magnetic fields officially flipped. This was not expected, said Arcioli. It's just something new we are finding out about the sun. The finding was surprising because the actual strength of the sun's magnetic field doesn't change much over the 11-year period, Linden added. During peak activity, the sun's magnetic field becomes more tangled, which leads to more activity like flares and eruptions on the surface, but the overall strength doesn't necessarily change. No one had any model that had said that certain portions of the sun would be brighter than others as a function of the solar cycle, but previous studies hinted at an unusual pattern, said Linden. He showed that certain areas of the sun are brighter than others in a previous study, but this new study analyzes the trends in more detail. Now, the models and understanding of our sun's gamma energies would need to be revised. Arcioli said that because this lopsided structure shows up at the time the sun is going through its magnetic flip, the gamma rays could be connected to magnetic configuration and solar activity. The exact explanation is still a mystery, and Elena Orlando, a study author and researcher at University of Trieste and Stanford University, One idea could be that the cosmic rays are hitting different regions during solar max, or perhaps there's something special about the poles during the solar maximum that attracts more cosmic rays to hit. There could also be a completely different explanation. This suggests that the gamma rays are carrying information about the solar activity, said Arcioli. It kind of opens up a new area to study this connection. Predicting an extreme solar event is like anticipating an earthquake. Processes below the surface start to shift and can trigger activity on the surface, but it's difficult to forecast exactly when and where. This study helps extend our knowledge of where exactly on the sun's surface the gamma rays are originating, said particle physicist Mer Unisa, who was not involved in the study. Previously, studies also hinted that gamma rays did not glow uniformly across the sun, but this is the first study to show a change during solar peak activity. Gamma rays could help provide an early look at the processes coming to surface and give clues about the overall condition of the sun, Orlando said. For instance, an increase in gamma radiation at the poles could signal the sun's magnetic field is in its process of flipping and that the sun's activity is increasing, leading to more solar eruptions that could hit Earth. Future studies could also look at how gamma radiation changes before a large solar flare, potentially using observations as a forecast tool, much like determining if it will rain on Earth from atmospheric conditions. The same magnetic fields that are responsible for modulating the high-energy particles that produce these gamma rays are also responsible for the ebbs and flows of space weather, Nisa said. Regardless of whether life is disrupted by space weather, getting the physics of our nearest star right will only add to our knowledge of our place in the universe. Finish up today, I'll read the big number. After steady decline, TB has increased every year since 2020. After decreasing for 27 years, the number of residents in the U.S. with tuberculosis has increased every year since 2020, with about 10,000 cases recorded last year from the 50 states and D.C., according to a report from Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. The finding was based on data from the agency's National Tuberculosis Surveillance System, which collects information from state and local health departments. Caused by bacteria, tuberculosis usually attacks the lungs and spreads easily from person to person through the air. People who have had the disease can spread the bacteria when they cough, sneeze, or simply talk. Although TB symptoms can include a cough, chest pain, fever, and weakness, many people who have been infected develop what is called a latent TB infection. That means that they have TB germs in their body and may need to take antibiotics, but those germs do not make them sick and they cannot spread TB to others unless the infection becomes active, which can happen if the person's immune system becomes weak. The latest numbers reflect a 16% increase in U.S. tuberculosis cases from 2022 to 23, and the highest number of TB cases in the country since 2013. The tally also reflects increases in all age groups and among people born in the U.S. as well as those born elsewhere, although the report found a larger increase among people born outside the U.S. versus U.S.-born individuals. Despite the recent increases, the CDC report describes the incidence of TB in the U.S. as among the lowest in the world. And that's going to do it for the Washington Post for today. This is Melinda Cornforth signing off. Have a great day.